In episode 21, we discuss deterrence theory with Dr. James Platy, helping to define terms and talk about practical applications for our listeners.
Right, you win the game of chicken by driving straight, by not swerving.
All right, hello and welcome to The Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war. I'm Major Aaron Warren, alongside Major Sheila Holder, and we will be your hosts today. With us today is Dr. James E. Platy, Assistant Professor at the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Dr. Platy received his PhD in International Relations from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and has held research fellowships with the East-West Center, Pacific Forum, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Harvard Kennedy School. Prior to accepting his position at SAMS, Dr. Platy was an assistant professor with the U.S. Air Force Center for Strategic Deterrence Studies, where he taught their course on deterrence. One of Dr. Platy's most recent publications, titled Bilateral Alliances in an Interconnected Cyber World, Cyber Deterrence and Operational Control in the U.S. Indo-Pacific Strategy, explored the crafting of the Allied cyber deterrence strategies in the region. Dr. Platy, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me on. It's really a pleasure to be here.
All right, sir. So starting out with the school year, we started in theoretical foundations. During that, we talked about coercion theory. And as students, I really thought that I don't believe that this is well understood, and I thought that this would be a fantastic podcast. We thought that this would be a fantastic podcast to use this episode to help our listeners out there better understand the different categories and terms associated with deterrence, as well as try to tease out some of the historical examples, and hopefully at the end have you make the case for us that deterrence is still vital in today's security environment and not just a Cold War relic. Are you think you're up to the task?
Well, I'll give it my best. I do want to make it clear at the beginning that there no course of measures were taken by you or Sheila to get me on here. I am here of my own accord. So we can have a general, casual conversation about coercion.
Got it. That makes sense.
Sounds good.
All right. Just so our listeners can understand, what is coercion theory? Can you sort of give us a quick overview of that?
Sure. So coercion, you could think of just generally as trying to influence another party to get a desired outcome or desired behavior. And in the theory, at least I think espoused by most scholars at this point, coercion takes two forms, deterrence and compellence. Deterrence being the more passive form, compellence being the more active form. But that is generally what you're trying to do. And you're just trying to influence decision-making to get an actor to do something or to not do something to get to that desired outcome or to that desired behavior. So we talk about coercion theory now, but if you just think of this, this is kind of typical human behavior. Human to human, you try to influence people at different points in your life. I'm not saying you walk around all day trying to coerce people, but...
Maybe.
Okay, well, I don't want to speak for you, Castle. you can think of that. And of course, this is very common throughout history in international relations. I think it's been only more recently, in the last century or so, that social scientists have kind of developed theory to describe and define this type of behavior.
So, sir, you kind of brought it up, but can you, so we have definition of coercion. Let's differentiate it from deterrence and compellence, just for the sake of terms.
Yeah. No, I think that's important because they do get conflated a lot. And I'll use the language that really American scholar Thomas Schelling introduced in 1966 in his book Arms and Influence, where coercion is sort of the higher level, and then the two forms of it are deterrence and compellence. So if you're thinking of coercion as generally just influencing, deterrence is sort of the passive form of coercion where you are trying to get an actor to not do something, and compellence being the more active, so you probably are having to do something to get an actor to do something. Now, that could be to get them to stop doing something as well, but you need a response from that actor, if that makes sense.
It does.
So I just to add on that, I think conceptually these are distinct, and it's easy to divide these two conceptually. In practice, it gets a lot messier in actually trying to distinguish between them two, whether deterrence is going on or compellence is going on. There's probably in practice a lot of times it's a blend of both. And so I think that's why you could then just raise it up to generally coercion theory, because maybe it's easier to think in practice how we're going to mix the two of these together. It also makes researching them a bit trickier, because if you're trying to distinguish between the two, and maybe you have different parts of a government, say one doing deterrence, one doing compellence, how do you distinguish between who is doing what? But conceptually, this is how you distinguish them.
The way that I'm tracking it, and sort of the way that you that you explained it, sir, is coercion, overall theory, and then you have sort of an active component, which is compellence, and you have a passive component, which is deterrence. What do you think of the JP3O sort of talks about that coercion is just the broad concept that encompasses two forms of intimidation. I like the term intimidation there. I think it, does that seem too hard, though, or too active, I guess?
Yeah, so it sounds tough to say you're intimidating someone. I don't think it quite captures the fullness that coercion theory can encompass. Certainly, if you're making a threat of punishment, of course, with deterrence, we often go right to nuclear weapons. So this sounds very intimidating. I'm going to rattle my nuclear saber in front of you, and that we're all going to be intimidated.
I just want to say that I appreciate you using the term nuclear. It's been 5 minutes, and we've been talking, and we haven't used the term nuclear yet. So
I hope you got the timer down on that. Someone will get the timer.
Yeah, we'll get the timer.
That was actually a pretty long run for me without saying the word nuclear. So I'm going to chalk that up as good work for the day. But, you know, that sounds intimidating. Now, you can do this with a lot of tools to deter. You could also do that to compel. You could think of bombing campaigns. At this point in my career, I have spent more time at an Air Force school, so I hope you'll forgive me for making a lot of air power type references.
You'll get no frustration.
But they are the strategic service. Moving on. But that's intimidation. But, you know, you could break deterrence in particular down even further, right? So we have, like, deterrence by punishment, which I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. So you tell an actor, if you do action X, we will nuke you. So that's a very punishing, intimidating type of deterrence threat. Deterrence by denial, though, is trying to tell the adversary that if they do the action, they will not receive the benefit from it. Now, maybe this is like through strong defenses or show your ability to recover quickly to not have the strategic benefit of conducting the action. So I don't really consider that intimidating if you just say that we have a resilient defense. So that's where I'm a little not in love with saying deterrence is all about intimidation.
That sort of brings up one of the readings, and I think it was, I'll have to go back through my notes from class, but one of the, or actually it really gets into the different waves of coercion theory and deterrence theory, right? Where there's a recognition that both sides are intelligent actors in that discussion.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you'd like, so you mentioned the waves. The waves really refer to just deterrence in particular, not necessarily compellence.
Okay.
At least how American scholars describe them. And again, I should say this is mostly speaking from an American perspective and U.S. Scholarly development of this, right? But the three waves. So it starts really 1946, and if you recall, it was before our time, but 1945.
I recall it like it was yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. Probably Dr. Stanley recalls it. But 1945, obviously the end of World War II, that ended with quite a punctuation mark, the dropping of two nuclear weapons on Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Japan. This immediately led a lot of people around the world, but particularly in the United States, thinking, so that seemed to just change how we will interact and potential and warfare. And so Bernard Brody and some other early scholars, many of whom who had obviously been in the military during the war, started thinking about this. Brody and some other folks put out a book in 1946 called The Absolute Weapon, which I would say is the beginning of the first wave. And this is mostly kind of deductive reasoning. What just happened? It seemed revolutionary. Let's maybe try and make some hypotheses about where international relations, where warfare is going now. This moves pretty quickly. You know, you get into the 50s, particularly places like Rand, Princeton, other universities as well, starting to apply a little more, I would say, scholarly rigor to it, particularly someone like Schelling, who I mentioned, brings in rational actor model from economics, and Schelling was an economist. So they bring in rational actor model and start building out theory based on that, about how you said about two intelligent actors. So, rational is the word used here. And of course, I mean, there's a difference that, you know, in the model, it's like you have an actor is presented different alternatives, and they choose the alternative that maximizes utility. And this comes out of economics, and you can think of this, you're going shopping, you're going to choose the product that brings you the most utility. So they apply this. You get to the third wave, and the third wave scholars, someone like Robert Jervis, Columbia, they try to sort of assess all of this and see how it's working in practice. See that it's very hard to prove. Obviously, deterrence is incredibly hard to prove in general, but this model seems hard to prove. They see that there's a lot of what one could term irrationality, but if you apply some tools from psychology and how humans actually make decisions, this is where like that strict rational actor model starts to break down. But it's not that people are irrational. They are still behaving really rationally. It's just that the model, I think, had some assumptions that don't always work out. And you can find people actually choosing win-win situations. Two rational actors butting heads in that model actually don't point to win-win. It's usually a zero-sum type of situation. But you can find people in practice choosing win-win. Rational actor model also assumes complete information, which is not possible in real life. So everyone naturally has biases and heuristics that they apply. And this is not negative, because if you did not do this and you tried to absorb all information, you would probably be frozen and unable to make a decision. At some point, you have to make a decision, right? You go shopping for a car. Do you know the entire universe of automobiles available to you? Okay, maybe that's a bad example for the audience.
He may, actually.
No, you're 100% right.
Right, but you don't know. So you have biases, you have heuristics you use to try and simplify it and make a good decision with sort of the information you have. But if you look at this now, this is rife for misperceptions, miscalculation, sort of missed signals between two sides, where you're trying to make the best decision out of maybe bad or incomplete information. And this is where a lot of the third wave comes in, of saying it's not that actors are irrational, but they're using, just like humans do every day, they're using their biases and their heuristics to make decisions. So the rational actor model, I think, is useful still as a starting point tool. But then when you get in particular cases, applying some of the other decision-making tools can help make sense of it. So that's really the third wave. I would argue that we still have scholarship that goes on in third wave.
Okay.
Because you're still trying to understand even just nuclear dyads, like U.S.-Soviet Union. I mean, you could still go back and do research on U.S.-Soviet crises to try and understand them. But you could apply this type of third wave thinking to any sort of deterrence relationship now. There is, at least in U.S. literature, been acknowledged a fourth wave after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, which looked at that, mostly looking at deterring terrorism and terrorists, also looking at deterring rogue states, at least what the U.S. perceives as rogue states. So really looking at asymmetric relationships. If before we were only concerned about the U.S. and Soviet Union, that was mostly viewed as symmetric, and now we're looking at these asymmetric relationships.
How does that jive with Bedell's idea that if you have an overmatched power, you could just use brute force and you don't need any level of deterrence, versus the asymmetric threats that we see whenever you sort of talk about new wave post 9/11 countering terrorism?
Right. So yes, you could use brute force where you're not trying to coerce, you're just imposing your will. And from a military perspective, you're just killing and destroying as much as possible. You could do that, and one could argue that's what a lot of war on terrorism type stuff was just going out and getting as many of the terrorists as we could. But I think the deterrence part is recognition that that is not going to get rid of the whole problem.
Yeah.
That is one tool in the bag. With the U.S.-Soviet nuclear relationship, deterrence, at least from the American view, was viewed as the only tool. Defense was not acceptable. Really, first strike was not an acceptable, like to brute force them or use nuclear weapons to compel the Soviets. None of these things really seemed as viable or way too risky from an American foreign policy perspective. For terrorism, though, deterrence is not the only tool. But if it reduces terrorist attacks by 10%, 20%, that's useful. And maybe you can try and get the others through brute force, through just going on the offensive and taking them out. So it's viewed as just a combination of these tools that can be used to try and reduce the threat from terrorism. Also, to be honest, deterring terrorists, if it doesn't work that great, it's annoying, but it's not an existential threat to the United States. Deterrence with the Soviets had to be done correctly because it was viewed as existential.
I think I was reviewing my notes from our class on deterrence, sir, and I came across like a comment that you made of how difficult deterrence is to observe and practice. And you've kind of alluded to that. Like, the terms are very clear. You can define it. We know what deterrence is. We try to do it. But in practice, when we want to study it after the fact, like, how do we really distinguish, like, what is good deterrence?
Yeah, well,
$1 million question, right?
Yeah. So very simply, more bombs deter more. That's
perfect.
Yeah, got it. Yep. Nailed it. You can actually Google that. There's a nice meme of somebody at a chalkboard with more bombs deter more. It's a linear relationship. You know, there is analytical work on this. An earlier work that I think is still worth reading, George and Smoke, Deterrence in American Foreign Policy, from maybe 1970 or sometime in the 70s. And so you can do it. I think you have to make a lot of assumptions, you know, because and ideally you would get to a lot of primary sources about what leaders were thinking. One, though, could even pick that apart. Maybe some leader wrote in his journal, you know, oh, we weren't deterred. I just decided not to attack today. Because thinking, like, what if someone reads this later? I don't want to look weak.
Mm-hmm.
So even that, like, it can be hard, but I think you make a lot of assumptions, right? So you assume, Mao Zedong really wanted to take Taiwan, right? So we assume that, and that's what they said. So in the Straits Crises from the 50s, we assume this is what China wanted to do. Here's all the things the U.S. did, because it's easier for us to research the U.S. side. Here's all the things we did, and in the end, the Republic of China was not invaded and remained autonomous. So we assume deterrence works. Now, is that convincing? Maybe. But I think that's kind of about as good as you can get. Now, maybe, of course, Mao was like, I wasn't going to. How are we going to conduct an amphibious invasion? We had basically no navy at that point, right? Like, maybe it wasn't even real. But that's what I mean. I think as a researcher, you also have to make assumptions about what adversary intentions and capabilities are and what our own are in order then to then say, well, if they meet these things, I will then conclude deterrence worked, but be very clear of saying these were my assumptions going into it. If these assumptions are wrong, probably the whole analysis is incorrect.
It made me think about in wave two, the sort of when the concepts of credibility, right? You need to have the capability as well as the resolve to use force. And then I think of like Dulles and the conversations we had about brinksmanship. And I think that's what most people think of deterrence as. And okay, well, I'm going to play a big game of chicken. And if the game goes off, then it's been successful. And therefore, I can call deterrence successful.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought up the game of chicken because that is like the most simple game presented for deterrence. So how do you win the game of chicken?
I was never very good at it.
Right. Well, I am a chicken. So Yeah, I'm not good at it either. So those who can't teach. So that's why I'm here. But, right, you win the game of chicken by driving straight, by not swerving.
That's a good point.
So actually, in the rational actor model for deterrence, the logical conclusion is for both sides to crash into each other. That is the logical outcome of it. Of course, this is the worst possible outcome for the world. So a lot of work goes into trying to make this not happen and to make swerving look like not losing, even though in the game of chicken, swerving is losing.
When you said drive straight, it also made me think about earlier you had also talked about you have to articulate like your red lines, right? Like that's where I immediately went, not making it appear that you were swerving but not swerving. I immediately thought of like, oh man, you gotta let your intentions be known.
Yeah, so okay, yeah, a couple things. Going back to, I remember what you initially said. So brinksmanship, and Schelling wrote a lot about brinksmanship, or the management of that. I think though, also to distinguish, that is really crisis deterrence, or you could say that's immediate deterrence, where you fear something is about to happen, or maybe the adversary has expressed something that they would like to do, and now you're in a crisis and you've got to do something to deter them, right? And maybe this is like all bombers on alert, or you know, you mobilize the entire force, you're trying to like show you're ready to hit back if necessary. That is distinguished from general deterrence. So the U.S. has a general deterrence policy of if you nuke us, we will nuke you back.
Good policy.
I think it's pretty solid. Good idea. But, you know, that's kind of like you don't need to brinksmanship that. That seems pretty clear and credible. But then to get to, like, red lines. Red lines, I think, has become a dirty word in deterrence because, and Schelling writes about this too, where a level of ambiguity is useful in deterrence. Because if you show the adversary exactly where the line is, it's potentially an invitation to go right up to the line, but not cross it.
Hmm.
And then really kind of dare the deterree or the deterring party to either take it, continue to take this lower level provocation, or act on your deterrent threat, which in a way can also hit at your credibility. Usually red lines are talked of as like, well, you set a red line, and then if they cross it and you don't respond, now your credibility is gone. And this was talked a lot about with Syria and chemical weapons. But if also you set a red line and an adversary doesn't quite cross it, but you still hit back, this now gets into also hitting on credibility because it looks like you're going to punish regardless. And Schelling writes about this too, that and it's called reassurance, to distinguish from you assure an ally. You also have to reassure the adversary that if they do not do the action, they will not get punished. Because if you tell them you're going to get punished regardless, then why would they stop? Well, just go ahead and do what I wanted to do anyway because I'm going to get punched in the face. So you need to reassure them that this will not happen. If you're a bit ambiguous, this gives you a little bit of wiggle room about also your decision to respond, but also should induce caution into the other side of saying, I don't know exactly where the line is, so I don't even want to get anywhere close to it because I may invoke a response that where I clearly miscalculated where the line was. But they were ambiguous, so they haven't really violated reassurance either. So this is where red lines become very challenging to do. I do think if you nuke the U.S. homeland, we will nuke you back. That's probably a pretty solid red line to still put in the sand.
Okay, that seems reasonable.
Yeah, I do want to make this clear. If you nuke the United States, we will probably nuke you back.
I like that you put probably there because none of us in this room get to make that decision, right?
That's
like
true. That's true. I think there is one person who gets to make that call.
Yep. And it's not Sheila Holder.
It is not.
So, but that also, one of my absolute favorite statements from Lawrence Friedman's book that we got to read, was that
privilege of
privilege to read
a small section?
Just a small section. It's a large book, sir. It's a very large book.
The deterrence book. It's only like 100 pages.
I was thinking of a different book. All right, sorry. I'm gonna cut that to make myself look smarter. Just gonna let you know that. Note to myself. After the attainment of nuclear weapons, nations no longer sought to win a war. They sought to avoid war. And I thought that was such an interesting change in the calculus for nations.
Yeah. So that was said by Bernard Brody. Friedman's quoting Brody, I'm taking a risk here by not having the quote in front of me, but he said, you know, up until this point that, you know, our militaries have been built to win wars. From now on, they must be, or their sole purpose is to avert wars. So to be clear, the context Brody's writing in, 1946, is in the aftermath of two devastating world wars. The second one just ended with the most powerful weapon we have ever made, still the most powerful weapon we've ever made. And I do want to be very clear on that. Like, the nukes are orders of magnitude larger than our largest conventional weapons. And so thinking, well, how can we not do that again? Especially if we do it again, it's going to be with nukes. So what he's specifically saying is we must avert general wars with other great powers who have nukes, because it can only end with pure devastation. Obviously, since 1945, plenty of wars have been fought, including the U.S. military has fought many wars, but we have not fought another large-scale war with a major power, with a nuclear-armed power. There have been limited wars between nuclear-armed countries, India, Pakistan, the Soviet Union, and China, but nothing that's really escalated to large general war. So that's really what Brody is saying. Because it's just seemed so unthinkable that we would actually fight that sort of war and now have nuclear weapons. And also World War II, what were the victory conditions in World War II for the Allies?
I mean, in that situation, it was unconditional surrender of Japan.
Unconditional surrender, yes. So now imagine if you got into a war where you seek unconditional surrender of the enemy and you have nuclear weapons. And this war has been going on for a while. Seems very tempting now to just start firing nukes. And if the other side has nukes, well, they're going to hit back or they're going to strike first because they're losing. And we've already told them we seek unconditional surrender and the removal of your government. So why not shoot your nukes? Because what is there to lose at this point? This is what Brody is writing is unthinkable, and our whole military has to be postured to not do that. I don't think Brody's specifically writing like, wars we had in Korea or Vietnam for more limited aims against adversaries who did not have nuclear weapons. I think, as big a concern. It does not represent the existential threat to the United States.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, this has in the literature been one of the questions explored. Like, if nuclear weapons were supposed to sort of be the end of politics, and bring about a peace. Yes, maybe the U.S. and Soviet Union didn't directly enter into war. The U.S. and China now have not directly entered into war, and maybe they won't because of nuclear weapons. I don't know. But why is there all this other war? And, you know, I think then it gets into this idea of, like, so what are nuclear weapons useful for? You know, it's not like, I don't think we seriously considered nuking North Vietnam. And in the Korean War, neither of the U.S. presidents during that war seriously considered using nuclear weapons against North Korea. But maybe it's still doing what Brody said, that we're still preventing this general war between major nuclear armed powers.
Okay. Well, it sounds like I had taken that quote a little bit out of context, so I appreciate the further education.
Yeah. I'll let your seminar leader.
Yeah, at least whenever I get to oral comps this year, I'll be able to say it correctly and hopefully be able to pass.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll be on your testing team and we can go even deeper into
it. I'm just gonna say nukes right at the beginning and then assume that I'm getting 81%.
That's all you need.
That's all I need.
So I think that ties in well to one of our next questions, is that deterrence isn't really emphasized during professional military education in the Army. So from your perspective, how can we as planners and, you know, our listeners in the operational force incorporate conventional deterrence or even like cyber deterrence in campaign planning?
Yeah, so I'm very biased in this, that I agree that I think deterrence should be emphasized more, but I understand there's a lot of competing priorities in professional military education, of things that you have to be competent in doing, things to learn about. But it seems striking to me that if our national security strategy is based on a thing called integrated deterrence, that we don't have more deterrence education in it. But I just work here. But I think for particularly where this program is, a useful thing to think of for planners is that much of your career, hopefully, will be in planning during competition or deterrence phase, not in open conflict. I hope not. But that, and to think that what you do to plan for deterrence is going to be different than what you do to plan for combat. And the actions you take for deterrence are different than the actions you take for combat. You know, deterrence theory does not say you have to be able to win the war in order to deter the war. One could argue the U.S. or North Korea produces deterrent effects against the United States just because it can deliver unacceptable damage to the United States. Out of some, you know, value calculation maybe between the two sides, that North Korea can do this against the United States. Even though if we entered into some sort of large war with North Korea, nobody really assumes North Korea would win if both sides just decide to go at it and go at each other. But I think the calculation is that they could deliver damage that we would not accept and probably withdraw from the war. So if you look at it that way, you know, what we do, the United States does to deterring China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, it's going to look different than if you actually entered into war with them. And if you presented a war plan for your deterrence, it may not actually be the right thing. Again, to go like to air power, you know, one thing we do for deterrence operations, bomber assurance and deterrence, or
those wonderful bomber task forces.
Whatever the Air Force is calling it these days, it's the same thing. It's flying B-52s, mostly B-52s around.
They're still very useful.
They are very useful, and I'm looking forward to the centenary flight. You know, if you're actually entering into combat, you probably wouldn't think, well, let's just have a bunch of B-52s fly around. Maybe they would be doing some combat sorties. Maybe B-52s aren't actually the platform you would use for it. I don't know, but what you do, like, kind of this, like, competition time deterrence versus combat are going to look different, and I think that is very useful for planners to understand. And I just gave a very nuclear example with B-52s, but this should be, I think, useful at any level domain of deterrence. What you're doing in the cyber domain for deterring is probably going to look different than if you were supporting combat operations in the cyber domain. And to think through how you're going to deter the adversary versus then, okay, we've entered into combat, now we got to switch to the combat plan. That is something I think is very useful to think of, rather than just being like, okay, I got to make a plan to beat the enemy in combat. But that's not what we're doing right now, so maybe that's not the most useful plan right now.
Sounds like all divisions should be thinking of mock deployments as the information space and
yeah,
a deterrence capability there.
Yeah, and it can apply to conventional deterrence too. How you would forward posture forces for some sort of deterrence swaggering, like a swaggering role, like, you know, we're putting forces forward in Poland or something. Whereas if there was actual combat operations against Russia on that front, maybe you wouldn't put them there. Maybe they would go somewhere else. So that is a difference too in the planning.
So we're getting closer to the end. I know in your most recent article, or at least the most recent article that we read, you talked about the bilateral alliances, specifically in U.S. Indo-PACOM, and you talked a little bit about North Korea and their ability to deter the United States, which I think is a really fantastic thing for people to think about, that it isn't just a the American powers or the Russians with nuclear weapons, but also smaller powers that have that capability. How do you think the role of deterrence plays as we move into thinking about cyber as well as operations in U.S. Indo-PACOM?
Yeah, so I think from the U.S. side, we would probably generally view it as we're trying to preserve some status quo, which is another possibly terrible phrase because nothing is ever static in international relations, but, you know, we got to preserve the status quo. But that's generally what we're trying to do. Generally, the alliance network, the trade system that we have, you're trying to preserve that. So it's mostly a deterrence-type operation. I think, though, for the other side of China and North Korea, who have expressed dissatisfaction with that status quo, they want it to change somehow, they still use deterrence, right? Because they're trying to now see, well, if we poked at the system in the U.S., you know, how would the U.S. respond? So now how do we deter that response from the United States? Or in the sort of the Chinese discussion on it, you can just talk more about coercion. Like the Chinese word that's most used for deterrence, we say, oh, it sounds like both deterrence and compellence. So maybe they're just talking about coercion rather than pure deterrence. But then it's both like a way to compel the United States out, or compel them to back down from alliance commitments, and then deter if conflict breaks out and you deter the U.S. or deter U.S. allies from entering. Because they also want to deter, say, Japan. I know particularly Japanese are concerned about this with North Korea. You would want to deter Japan from allowing the U.S. to use bases on Japanese territory to support operations in, say, Korea. And this presents, like, a very difficult problem for Japan because it's like, well, do we potentially take North Korean attack or do we potentially break the alliance with the U.S. by saying we're not going to allow combat operations out of Misawa or Kadena or something like that? So I think this is where, you know, all sides are thinking about deterrence or coercion in how to either preserve or to upset the status quo. And, you know, you read the title of the article, Bilateral Alliances. Of course, for the Indo-Pacific, it's interesting in a way, like the bilats for the U.S. On the one hand, I think they can be easy to manage because you're bilateral. On the other hand, though, if you need both Japan and the Philippines and Australia to all support what looks like a U.S.-led operation, now this is probably more challenging than NATO or a multilateral alliance.
So, sir, before we kind of close out here, what do you think our listeners should contemplate when someone mentions deterrence in the future? What would you like us to think about?
Well, we should all think back to, you know, what would Curtis LeMay do?
Nice.
I think, so particularly probably for this audience, you know, what I said about what we plan for combat and deterrence are different. I also would encourage to not think of deterrence so much in a binary yes or no, deterrence working or not. That's not, I don't think that's the most useful way to think of something. You can think of deterrence a bit more of on a spectrum, or I also like saying the phrase produce deterrent effects, because we are probably not going to know beforehand is the adversary being deterred, but maybe we can try and think we're having some sort of effect, but it's also not static, so maybe it was effective yesterday, is it effective today? Not sure, but to not think of it so binary. Also, to be clear on, sometimes I think we should be clearer on what is deterrence and what is compellence. As a little pet peeve of mine, hearing people say, oh, we failed to deter North Korea from developing nuclear weapons. First, incredibly hard to do, to convince someone not to develop capabilities. Also, when did we start this effort? The early 1990s, after North Korea had decided to make nuclear weapons. So you're technically doing compellence then. You're maybe trying to deter other pathways for them to pursue nuclear weapons, but you're not really deterring anymore. Now, this is, I think, more than just a semantic argument, because it matters in how you think about how to deal with the problem. And in the literature, it's said compellence is usually harder than deterrence, because it's harder for the other side to know when are we in compliance, when does the punishment stop, how much compliance do I need. So while it can be hard to distinguish, sometimes you need to decide, well, no, we are not really in deterrence right now. We're in another phase here, and this is going to affect how I implement policy toward it. The last thing I would say is, since deterrence occurs in humans' minds, it's up to the adversary to decide if they are deterred, not us. So one of the most important things and useful things you can do in deterrence is studying your adversary. It's useful to know about what the U.S. can do, what our doctrine is, declared policies, but incredibly useful to read about the other people we are trying to influence, and to read about their decision-making process, to read about their internal politics, because we also a lot of times view it as it's all about us and what we're doing, whereas for the most part, they're probably also looking at it, it's all about us because we have our own domestic politics, or, you know, it's us and the Taiwanese. Why are the Americans even here? This, like, it doesn't make sense. So, but to try and understand that mindset of the other side, because that is who you have to influence, whether you're deterring or compelling. So you can try and understand yourself, but it's not going to matter if you don't understand what the other side wants or how they think.
Well, not that you're our adversary, but we would like to get a little bit more information and know you a little better.
From your perspective, what do you think is important to highlight about operational art for our listeners?
In my mind, at least, the core of operational art is linking strategy to tactics. And strategy is something that is above military. So if you want to really be good at operational art, and this is, I think, pretty good for military students, you must understand the other aspects of government and of society. The understanding, the diplomatic part, information, economics. Don't stovepipe them the way that that word sounds. Dime sounds like we just look at the D and then we sprinkle in some I. And if we do D, I, and E, now it sounds like they die. But
I made that joke.
Oh, it's a good joke.
It's a great joke.
It is, yeah. I'm surprised more people don't use it. It's like we can get people to die without using military.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I know, snazzy. So, but to not think of that as stovepipe, but how it all works together, and I'm not trying to reference multi-domain operations. I probably had to say it at some point during this. So I've satisfied that requirement. But that you can, you can try and understand, oh, the strategy is to, stabilize the region, whatever our strategic goal is, and then think, all right, this is all the military I apply. I'm just going to present the military option, best military option. Here's the best military option. But if it is completely devoid of any sort of information, economic, diplomatic thinking, it's probably not of great use to political leadership, because they could say, like, that's great. It's going to kill way too many people. It's almost like way too successful. We're going to kill a lot of people, and that's going to not meet the strategic goal here. So I think, like, as much as we need to understand the military part of it, if it's devoid of the other aspects, then it's not going to be good operational art.
That makes sense. And then the final question, because we all love to read. What are the book suggestions or some book suggestions or podcast suggestions that you might have for us as well as our listeners to maybe get more intelligent on deterrence moving forward?
You know, a couple of the books I've mentioned definitely like are kind of foundational, I would say, from Brody, Schelling, George and Smoke. I think one of the best scholars today, for at least from the U.S. side, is Brad Roberts. Who is the head of a place called the Center for Global Security Research at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. He was a DASD under Obama, essentially the lead author for the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review. After his government service, he went out to Livermore. But that, I mean, he himself has written a book, Case for Nuclear U.S. Nuclear Weapons in the 21st Century, that's a few years old at this point, but still, I think, really good arguments. And his center puts out a lot of good stuff. But even just looking at some of the podcasts or lectures he's done on YouTube, I think he's one of the best at also taking these very complex situations, very complex ideas, and breaking it down, presenting it in a way that's easily understandable and digestible. So I think he is one of the top scholars out there to be reading.
Okay. Any other books that you maybe not necessarily about deterrence, but you think that that we should read? I don't want to try to just pigeonhole you into only talking about deterrence.
Yeah, no. Oh, well, I should plug a very recent book.
Okay.
Called The Sister.
The Sister.
Yeah, The Sister. It's relevant. So it was written by a gentleman, Sung-Yoon Lee, who was my Korea Studies professor at the Fletcher School. He's now at the Wilson Center in D.C. The Sister is about Kim Jong-un's sister, but it's also more generally about the North Korean regime, about basically the royal family in North Korea and how they operate, how they think. There was a similar book a few years ago, I'm blanking on the title right offhand, but it was about Chang Sung-taek, who was Kim Jong-un's uncle. By marriage, his uncle, who he had executed by, air defense. Yeah. Anti-aircraft guns. But also, I think these studies are what I was talking about, deterrence. Like, understanding, particularly in this type of system, the ruling family and how they think and how they operate. If you're looking to deter them, you need to understand these internal dynamics. So The Sister is a new book. It just came out last month that I think is a good look at how that ruling family and that ruling class thinks and behave.
Well, Dr. Plotty, thank you very much for being here today. And I think this concludes this episode of the podcast.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for being here.
The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by checking us out on Twitter at US_SAMS, Instagram at US.SAMS, and on LinkedIn. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or wish to engage with us, please email us at operationalarch@gmail.com.